Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we're going to spend the hour discussing the real reasons behind the United States military assault on Venezuela last weekend and the capture of the country's leader, Nicolas Maduro. In the past few days, Trump and his team have repeatedly claimed that the United States is now the de facto leader of Venezuela and in charge of its critical oil sector. In his recent piece in The Nation, our guest Peter Kornbluh writes about the implications. He says, indeed, Trump's empire-building posture of might makes right is a direct assault on the entire world order of international law and respect for the sovereign rights of all states. Beyond violating the War Powers Act at home, the attack on Venezuela has undermined numerous international accords abroad, among them the OAS and UN charters. Trump's unilateral exercise of power against a small regional nation legitimizes the expansionist ambitions of other major powers who claim their own spheres of influence and control, Russia in the former Soviet states and its near abroad, and China in Taiwan and the South China Sea. Peter Kornbluh, a longtime contributor to The Nation on Cuba, is co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. He's also the author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Good to have you on the show with us, Peter.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
Glad you can join us. And we're also pleased to be joined by Branko Marcetic. He's a Jacobin staff writer and the author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Good to have you back with us, Branko.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Now, Trump's attack on Venezuela and his repeated threats against other countries, including Cuba, Mexico, Chile, as well as Greenland, they're definitely grabbing a lot of media attention globally. But before we dive in and talk about what the U.S.'s endgame in Venezuela might be and the broader consequences, I just wanted to ask you both, what explains Trump's obsession with Venezuela in the first place? How did we get from a so-called America First and no more wars agenda to bombing multiple countries, attacking boats in the Caribbean, and now this military attack on the nation of Venezuela? Peter, let me start with you on that.
Well, I just want to say that Trump has had this obsession since his first term. You can go back and read the memoirs of John Bolton, who served as Trump's national security advisor. And Trump basically, according to those memoirs, basically asked, why can't we just invade Venezuela? And as Bolton put it, Trump seemed to feel that Venezuela belonged to the United States. And I think that tells you a lot about Trump's kind of attitude towards countries like Venezuela. He either believes that we already own them or we rightfully should control them or that we should own them. He's just given an interview in the New York Times. It's on the front page today about ownership of Greenland, et cetera, and how as a real estate mogul, he really likes to own things. But by and large, he's basically saying now we own at least symbolically, Venezuela and its oil fields. And that's been his kind of true kind of focus, not democracy, not human rights, not freedom, not adherence to international law, but rather the United States having a land grab in a country nearby where it can take over what are essentially the largest oil reserves in the entire world.
And Branko, let me turn to you with that same question. What do you think explains what's happening here? Maybe building on what Peter just described.
I mean, you know, I could talk for an hour about all the factors going in here, but I think, you know, alluding to what Peter mentioned, Venezuela has long been a prize in the eyes of a lot of the more hawkish foreign policy establishment in the United States. You know, goes way beyond Trump. Venezuela, you know, because it had this leftist government, because it took this sort of confrontational and rebellious posture to the United States in a part of the world where U.S. Policymakers are used to kind of being able to dictate what they want to happen, being able to push around smaller countries. Kind of reducing that independence has been a key goal of the foreign policy elite in Washington. So, you know, this is the whole point of the sanctions that have been around for years on Venezuela, way before Trump came to power. The idea was to make, similar to Cuba, make life so miserable for the people of Venezuela, that it A, delegitimizes some of the very real economic progress that was made under the previous president, Hugo Chavez, and then B, that to make people kind of rebel and overthrow the government. That did not happen. And so, you know, you had to kind of take this more heavy-handed measure. And I think one other thing I would say, you know, how we got to Trump running on a sort of America first anti-interventionist platform to toppling the leader and kidnapping the leader of a foreign country. A big part of that is Marco Rubio, his Secretary of State. All the reporting we have is that Rubio was instrumental in convincing Trump to take this. He kind of manipulated Trump, convinced him that Venezuela was a key player in the drug trade and that removing Maduro would be an important scalp for him in that political project. And it seems to have worked on Trump and got him to carry out this, I think, very reckless operation.
Yeah, Peter, I wanted to follow up there on Bronco's point about the role potentially of Marco Rubio, Trump's Secretary of State. What are you hearing and reporting on in terms of Rubio's role in all of this?
Well, there are two other roles behind Trump that are worth considering. But before we consider them, I just want to say that even though those points are valid and very important to study, Trump is a puppet of nobody and a front man of nobody. He wants to demonstrate his own personal power, not just in our own country, the United States of America, but around the world. I think it's important to note that Trump has a sense of himself as an emperor, and an emperor needs an empire. And that, I think, accounts for his focus on Greenland and Venezuela and the Panama Canal Zone and Colombia and Cuba and Mexico. To be able to assert his power when he wants to assert it. Now, behind the scenes, what's been going on for 6 months at least now, if not a little longer since last spring, is Stephen Miller and Marco Rubio working on kind of the broader agenda that that they have, which is anti-immigration, deportation policy, overthrowing the communist government of Cuba, which has been Rubio's goal since he became senator, 15, 20 years ago. Now he has the levers of power to do it. And both Miller and Rubio were able to present a plan to Trump that started with blowing up these small boats in the Caribbean and killing people, focusing on ousting Maduro. Once Maduro was gone, Stephen Miller's kind of Machiavellian vision was hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who are in the United States as immigrants would no longer have a claim to asylum and could be more easily thrown out of the country. If Maduro was gone, many immigrants from Venezuela in the United States would be more likely to return voluntarily to Venezuela. So this was very Machiavellian. And I think for Rubio's point of view, he has been targeting Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua for a number of years, going back to the first term of the Trump administration, pushing for that when he was senator. Now he has the levers of power. He's both the national security advisor, the president, and the secretary of state. Now he's basically going to be viceroy to Venezuela, controlling the future of that country, kind of in remote control imperialism, if you will, from a distance. And so it's a rather extraordinary set of circumstances. I didn't think I'd ever live to see it, but here it is. And it's extremely important because it's a signal to the rest of Latin America, and if not the rest of the world, of what this administration thinks its powers should be globally.
Well, and speaking of what's going on in terms of their rest of the world and their reaction to it, it's been a pretty mixed international reaction. Bronco, you've written about the EU and some of the leadership in the EU, particularly among the EU centrists, and how they've really sort of fallen down in terms of how they're reacting to this reaction, to this invasion. So, Bronco, can you talk a bit about what's going on now in the international community, particularly in the EU, and what this means for the tensions going forward between the United States and the EU?
Well, you would have thought, you know, if you looked at the EU reaction to the criminal Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, you know, they all quite rightly denounced as this terrible violation of international law and national sovereignty and basic norms that have kind of steered the world for the last few decades. You would have thought that they would have had the same kind of response to this thing, you know, Trump basically just kidnapping a foreign leader that he didn't like and taking him to US soil to be tried. But no, many European leaders basically put out a series of very similar statements, seemed like they were drafted from basically the same kind of memo that whose aim seemed to be to say as little as possible, to kind of maintain some sort of public commitment to international law, nominal commitment, even as they were refusing to condemn or really say anything in opposition to what was a flagrant violation of that law. And to their shame, you know, a lot of these European centrists and liberal leaders who spent years, making people feel, convincing them that they had a really genuine belief in these principles, they ended up putting out statements that were far less condemnatory than even some members of the far right in Europe. I mean, Marine Le Pen in France put out a far more forthright statement basically saying this is completely unacceptable. And she's someone whose politics much more overlap with Trump's than the rest of these leaders. So to me, it's this is kind of the double tragedy of what's happening here. Is not just that we have this violation. I mean, you know, violations of international law and so on happen, unfortunately, on a semi-regular basis. But what you can usually count on is for the international community, as we call it, to uniformly condemn it and to say this is unacceptable and we will stand against it. And here we don't even have that. It's a sort of quiet, tacit assent by the Western world. And I think that is going to only compound global cynicism towards, you know, what are seen as Western double standards and the intentions of Western governments.
Peter Cornwell, anything you want to add about the international reaction?
Well, I think Branko's entirely correct. The European Union is kind of taking a realpolitik pragmatic position. They're not going to try and antagonize Trump over Venezuela when they are desperately hoping they can still convince him to support opposition to Russia in Ukraine, even though the incredible implication of what Trump has done in Venezuela is that the United States should have the right to its sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere, and Russia should have the right to its sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. And so you can imagine how concerned everybody is in Europe about the implications of what Trump is doing here. But I think the implications are quite direct. Trump does not give a whit for international law. He has come out now, and this is on the front page of the New York Times today, and simply said, I don't need international law. The only thing is stopping me, as I'm quoting, is, quote, my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop me. I don't know that anybody in Europe or anywhere ever thought that the leader of the United States of America would ever be making such a bald, flagrant statement of might makes right and the use and abuse of superpower glory, essentially. And this, I think, is a scary proposition for everybody, not just leaders and countries in Latin America, but leaders and countries in Europe, in fact, the entire free world at this point.
Yes, especially when you can figure out how the Congress has not been doing their job and with the U.S. Supreme Court not really holding back either the executive branch. You can see how we're in this situation where we are essentially now at the whims of the morality of a president. So if you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. We are talking about the real reasons for the Trump administration attack on Venezuela. We're joined by Peter Kornbluh, longtime contributor to The Nation,
and also by Branko Marcetic, a Jacobin staff writer. And we want to hear from you as well. If you have thoughts or questions about what's going on in Venezuela, why the U.S. is involving itself, abducting President Nicolas Maduro, what the end game is, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Now, Peter, you wrote back in November in a piece in Foreign Policy that some sort of military attack on Venezuela at that point appeared imminent. Why did you think it was inevitable that this military buildup in the Caribbean was essentially a prelude to an actual strike?
Well, I think it was absolutely clear. I know a lot of people thought that Trump was going to do his taco thing, you know, chicken out, or it was just bluffing. But it didn't make sense that it was a bluff to make the expenditure of time and energy to move all of those military battleships into the Caribbean, openly send the CIA into Venezuela, start to engage in back-channel talks with Maduro directly. I mean, all signs pointed to an effort, a concerted effort to get rid of Maduro. We're going to be learning a lot more about kind of the behind the scenes activities that went on over these last few months, which included the Vatican playing a role as an intermediary, offering Maduro free passage to refugee status in the Vatican, Russia saying they would take Maduro, et cetera. But I think it was clear that this was going to be the place that Trump asserted, the historical, trajectory of the United States, a return to gunboat diplomacy in the region. And that's why I hate to say we were right, but we were.
Well, you definitely were correct. And Branko, I wanted to ask you about sort of what happens here next. So Trump removed Maduro, but the regime is still intact, and we're learning more about what's happening here behind the scenes. We have Professor Alejandro Velasco writes in an op-ed in The Guardian that at this point, information suggests that over a decade of tight cohesion around Maduro, his inner circle calculated they were better off without him and struck a deal with the Trump administration. So what do you think is happening here in terms of the next steps for who's going to govern Trump? Who's going to govern Venezuela and how Trump's administration will be involved in this?
Well, that is the big question. And it's a question that is not really being asked by what I have seen as just too much triumphalist celebration. You know, we've sort of taken the George W. Bush mission accomplished, the infamous mission accomplished banner, and we have moved that decoration not 2 months out from the start of a war, but just three, four days out from this operation. We really have no idea how this is going to turn out. The Venezuelan leadership currently has to walk this very, very difficult tightrope, where on the one hand, Trump has said, if you don't do what I want you to do, I will basically do the same thing I did to Maduro to you. So the current president, Delcy Rodriguez, she has to, on the one hand, appease Trump. On the other hand, she is reliant on the Chavista leaders of who run the security forces in Venezuela, and they are much less inclined, I think, to compromise with Trump. And who knows what their exact red lines are in terms of where they will no longer brook compromise from her with Trump's demands. Meanwhile, you have, tens of thousands of heavily armed people in militias. You have guerrillas from Colombia that have their own kind of private fiefdom carved out in parts of Venezuela. Venezuela is a tinderbox, much like any country has been stuck in a prolonged political crisis for years, but then also is left in what is a power vacuum. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a chance, and we should all hope that the country is able to maintain stability, that, that Rodriguez is able to kind of toe this line and appease both Trump and some of the more kind of less pragmatic members of her government. But there is also a very high chance that she is unable to do that, and that, and the conflict starts to bubble up. I mean, you know, as Trump goes to take Venezuela's natural resources for the United States, are some of these guerrilla groups and militias, are they going to stand by and let that happen, or are they going to attack whoever's trying to do it? And at that point, if you start getting U.S. soldiers who are being killed or injured or kidnapped or who knows what, then that starts to increase the pressure on Trump to get more involved. So, that, you know, we really have no idea what's going to come next. And I think a lot of the celebration and a lot of the statements of mission accomplished are way, way, way too premature.
Absolutely. We've seen that story before with U.S. foreign policy. I want to go ahead and reintroduce the program. I understand my audio may not have been super clear when I did it last time. I want to let folks know you're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're talking about the U.S. attack on Venezuela, the capture of President Nicolas Maduro, and what the real reasons might be for this intervention, what might come next. We're joined by Peter Kornbluh, longtime contributor to The Nation on Cuba specifically. Also joined by Branko Marcetic, Jacobin staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man, the case against Joe Biden. And the phone lines are open. If you want to join the conversation, you have questions about what's going on with U.S. foreign policy in Venezuela and the Caribbean region in general, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. And we have Greg on the line from Palo Alto. So, Greg, welcome to Your Call.
Hello. Thank you. You know, over a year ago, when Rose was covering Contract 2025, I asked a question which went right over the heads of everybody, and that was, what's the military going to do? Are they going to abide by their constitutional oath, or are they just going to follow Trump? Well, we've got the answer, all right? They're going to follow, and they're going to do what Trump wants them to do. So that's one thing. The other thing is, what does this mean for, you know, when I saw that he had attacked Venezuela, I just thought, you know what, all bets are off. Anything can happen in the United States at this point. It, you know, if people think that Trump is going to somehow allow elections to occur in 2026, I think they better rethink that. And then lastly, I just say this. Who is going to stop this? What or who is going to stop this? He has all the might. He's got all three levers on all three branches of the government. And he just seems to be willing to do anything, and the people behind him are willing to do it and join him. So I just don't know how this is going to end up, and I think it's headed in a very bad direction.
Yeah, Greg, I appreciate your concerns. And Branko, maybe I'll let you take the first crack there at what Greg is raising in terms of military compliance with potentially illegal orders, lack of political pushback, and where this might be heading.
Well, I will say the Senate just the other day did advance a war powers resolution. There were five Republicans that joined it. So there is the glimmers of Congress finally actually acting on its constitutional prerogative and reasserting the fact that the only Congress has the right to declare war and to launch military actions like this. You know, unfortunately, that will likely, even if it passes the House, that will be vetoed by Trump almost certainly. And there aren't the numbers to override that veto. So this is cold comfort. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in terms of what is going to stop this, you know, the Trump administration, Trump and the officials he has around him, they are very much riding high after this. They are feeling very, very strong. They're feeling very, very confident. You know, they're marveling at the kind of operation that the U.S. military is capable of, at least against a very weak and economically decaying country in the form of Venezuela. And of course, you know, you hear these threats that Trump is now making. Well, we're going to do the same to Cuba, Mexico, better watch out. Colombia, better watch out. Despite this rhetoric, I think it is important to keep in mind that the United States does not have infinite military supplies. This has been made very clear in the last few years, where, I mean, one of the reasons why Trump is trying to extricate the United States from the war in Ukraine is because it very quickly turned out that the U.S. did not have the manufacturing capacity to actually sustain the level of weaponry that it was supplying to Ukraine to keep that war going, while also, you know, simultaneously planning to potentially fight a war with China, and while also, you know, having to deal with things in the Middle East. So the United States remains as overstretched as ever. I am very skeptical that it is going to be able to both continue to threaten Venezuela, which is going to require, you know, the level of military buildup that has happened over the last some number of months is going to have to be sustained now indefinitely in order to patrol the waters, make sure ships aren't going places, be able to kind of, you know, credibly threaten the country. While at the same time, you know, the U.S. is feeding Israel and everything it's doing in the Middle East. And it's also, you know, simultaneously, again, preparing for war with China. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be able to do all of this. So there are constraints, just physical constraints. But having said all that, that does not mean that the Trump administration cannot do damage while it's kind of at least pretending to be this sort of limitless superpower. And I think that's the most worrying thing, is that they can continue to do sort of reckless, small scale, but reckless and very damaging operations.
Yeah. And Peter Cornbill, your reaction to that, I mean, is, first of all, you know, just to respond to Greg's comments there, are you also alarmed about the direction here in terms of the legal political constraints, if any, on Trump's use of military force going forward? And also your reactions to Bronco's point about the U.S. really kind of losing capacity to follow through on a lot of the threats and foreign conflicts that it's involved in.
Well, if I haven't made it clear enough that I'm alarmed, I certainly haven't conveyed very clearly my thoughts on your program. But I'm alarmed, and I think everybody around the world, and I think almost every major leader around the world should be alarmed and is alarmed by Trump's assertion of just omnipotent U.S. power that basically comes down to his will, to his whimsical, narcissistic effort to self-aggrandize his own sense of power. That he's targeted that on the United States itself. Now he's targeting it around the world, starting with the traditional U.S. sphere of influence, Latin America. I have a slightly different take than Bronco. I think that the lesson that Trump has learned and his people have learned from this attack on Venezuela is that a few strategic bombs, drone strikes, special operations forces are sufficient to strike fear and intimidation and move forward with U.S. objectives. I completely agree that the situation in Venezuela is incredibly unstable and will get more unstable. But I don't think you're going to see a plan of boots on the ground like Trump threatens. I think he will be dropping strategic bombs on the heads of specific Venezuelan generals and interior ministers, et cetera, who aren't cooperating with him, in order to get rid of them or send a message to everybody else, you know, deal with us or else. And I think that's the "or else" is going to be basically the operational motto of U.S. foreign policy in Venezuela and other countries in the world.
Well, we're almost out of time, but Peter, I have to ask you just what do you think this all could mean for Cuba specifically? I know that's a big part of your focus. So what do you think are the implications for U.S. relationships with Cuba, which has obviously really dominated foreign policy off and on since the early 1960s in the U.S.?
Well, Marco Rubio has set out to undermine and overthrow the regime in Cuba. He now has the levers of power and the position to do so. I think Trump would like to access and annex and be the king of Cuba as well as the king of Venezuela and the owner of all of Latin America. And Cuba is definitely in the crosshairs of this administration and is next on their list for regime change. And they are going to cut off the oil that came from Venezuela to Cuba. They are pressuring the president of Mexico to cut off Mexican shipments of oil to Cuba. And I think they're going to be patient to wait for the Cuban economy to collapse, basically from the cutoff of these economic necessities, and then move on from there.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you both so much for coming on the program and explaining what's going on in Venezuela. Obviously, a lot more we could talk about, but I just want to thank you both. Peter Kornbluh, longtime contributor to The Nation on Cuba and co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Thank you, Peter, for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Branko Marcetic, Jacobin staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Thank you for joining us on Your Call.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, we've got more to talk about with Venezuela. Coming up next, we'll talk about court proceedings and how the adventures that the United States is engaging in Venezuela could potentially create a corporate windfall for plaintiffs in international court. That's coming up next on Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website at kalw.org. Just click on news and you can find our program listed there. You can also listen to our past shows on our website and sign up for our newsletter so you never miss a show and find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line. We are at yourcall@kalw.org. And we always welcome phone calls from our listeners with ideas, suggestions. The number to call to send us your feedback or your ideas for show topics is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And now we're going to keep on with the theme of Venezuela, talking about the big military intervention last weekend to bring troops into Venezuela and capture President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. And we're going to talk about how U.S. corporations have potentially positioned themselves to cash in on what's happening in Venezuela. According to the investigative news outlet The Lever, before Donald Trump's attempt to remove President Maduro from power, corporations filed lawsuits against Venezuela seeking damages related to state nationalization, international sanctions, and political instability. A Trump-installed government could tilt the courts in their favor. So here to talk more about this is Luke Goldstein, a reporter at the investigative news outlet The Lever. He co-wrote the piece with Lucy Dean Stockton entitled Corporations Invested in Lawsuits Before the Venezuela Invasion. Good to have you back with us, Luke.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me back on.
So, Luke, a few days ago, Trump said he spoke to U.S. oil companies prior to the raid on Venezuela this past weekend, even as he said he didn't disclose those plans to members of Congress. A few days ago, Senator Elizabeth Warren posted that instead of giving Congress a heads up that he ordered U.S. troops to attack Venezuela and seize its president, Donald Trump tipped off oil companies. We know that in 2024, Trump promised oil executives massive profits in exchange for $1 billion in campaign contributions. And you recently reported that a few weeks before the American military operation in Venezuela, the U.S. energy giant Halliburton filed an unusual lawsuit in international court claiming that the Venezuelan government owes them damages for U.S. sanctions against the country. So I guess I just have to ask, does all of this mean that oil executives knew something was going to happen and were potentially involved in what went on militarily last weekend?
Well, I think the oil interests are absolutely a really key piece of this. I can't speak exactly to what knowledge they had before or whether they learned about this after. I've seen some conflicting reports. But, you know, I think really what you can say is that this U.S. invasion of Venezuela, the capture of President Nicolas Maduro, soft coup, whatever you want to call it at this point in time. It was really met with almost nothing short of kind of ecstasy from the broad business community, which have a variety of financial interests in the country. And one window into the specific kind of list of companies and investors that, you know, would have a kind of major stake in some sort of change of government, regime change, more U.S. influence on the country at the very least, is to look at these lawsuits that have been filed for a number of years in international arbitration court by mostly U.S. companies and investors. They're seeking financial damages from the government of Venezuela. And the latest one, it was filed just a couple weeks before the invasion happened, was by, you know, by Halliburton, one of the largest American energy companies. And what they're claiming in their case, which is a little bit unusual for how these lawsuits go, is they have said that they suffered about $200 million in losses between 2016 and 2020, and that Venezuela owes them money. Now, what they actually also admit in their filings is that this is because they were withdrawing their operations from the country to comply with U.S. sanctions, which were ramped up in first 2017 and then 2020. But they're not suing the U.S. They're saying that Venezuela owes them the money here. And, you know, I think the kind of contradictions in this case have raised a number of questions. One would be, did Halliburton, in anticipation of an invasion, kind of, you know, throw this lawsuit at the wall and just kind of see what would stick? I mean, again, it's they're filing it this year. All the damages were from years and years ago, expecting that there would be maybe a more favorable government coming into power who would be able to award them these damages. And, you know, it sort of speaks, I think, in general, more broadly, to a lot of the issues with these international arbitration tribunals that critics have kind of been raising for a number of years.
And what do these lawsuits have in common? Is this all about economic damages related to them having to pull out now of Venezuela because of the sanctions?
Yeah, so there's a few different buckets. The most common variety of these cases, which it's technically called investment state disputes settlement, ISDS for short. There are these arbitration courts overseen. They're a division of the World Bank, and you know they kind of adjudicate these issues. They're always between outside investors that are suing a sovereign nation because of state policies that have been implemented that, you know, essentially they claim have violated international law and caused them damages. The most common ones against Venezuela, and these have been ongoing for years and years, are largely because of under former President Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro, the state seizure of various private assets, you know, nationalization efforts for short. There was a huge $9 billion settlement with the oil and gas company ConocoPhillips a number of years ago over the seizure of its oil operations. The Koch brothers, Koch Industries, were also awarded hundreds of millions of dollars, about $444 million, I think, specifically. For a seizure of one of its agriculture divisions in the country. So usually it's over these nationalization efforts. And again, this is kind of what makes the Halliburton case stand out, is they were suing about, you know, a withdrawal of their operations that was trying to comply with a change in U.S. law that was imposed against Venezuela. And I think it sort of, In a broader sense, kind of shows you that these courts, by and large, have kind of been, you know, some would say, you know, weaponized in a number of cases by, you know, other, you know, various kind of U.S. investors to punish, you know, kind of smaller nations that are cash strapped. I mean, these damages add to their debt and such.
And has Halliburton changed their lawsuit at all since the military attack? Have there been any updates?
So one thing that I can report to you about these cases from trying to dig into them is that another one of the issues, there's not a lot of information that's actually given. The filings, I mean, these cases will take place over a number of years, and the filings are kind of sparse. They are held in sort of basically backroom private deals. You don't get, you're not able to get access to the full proceedings in the way that you are in, you know, open, you know, U.S. court, other legal systems. You can get final settlements, that are eventually disclosed. And, you know, a lot of the information we have about Halliburton's is really brief summaries, that are currently posted on the ISDS, International World Bank website. And other, you know, kind of reports. But again, what is clear based on even their kind of brief summaries is they're saying that there was currency manipulation, domestic instability in Venezuela. And they also do list, you know, U.S. sanctions on here. By and large, what you can assume about those cases is that it's more about, you know, kind of targeting nationalization efforts by first the Chavez and Maduro government.
We're speaking with Luke Goldstein, reporter at the investigative news outlet The Lever. He's co-written a piece with Lucy Dean Stockton titled Corporations Invested in Lawsuits Before the Venezuela Invasion. This is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable, and I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. And we're talking about corporations potentially filing lawsuits in anticipation of this military action, or at least potentially going to benefit from this military action. And the number to call to join the conversation if you have questions about what's happening, questions for Luke about these lawsuits, the number to call to join is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. So, Luke, it sounds like what you're suggesting one possibility here might be is that a favorable Venezuelan administration, favorable to Trump and the oil industry's interests, could potentially settle out some of these cases or find ways to ultimately find in favor of these oil companies. Can you talk about the history of this happening? We know that Venezuela has been facing 9 pending cases launched by investors and major corporations that are alleging financial damages, and that the country has settled dozens in recent decades. So can you talk about how this might play out if there is a favorable regime now in Venezuela that wants to curry favor with the oil industry and Trump?
Right. So, I mean, you know, one thing to say is I think, frankly, the piece may have undersold the list of companies here. There are 9 pending cases that haven't, you know, yet fully been adjudicated by these courts. There are scores of other cases where the investors, companies, have been awarded damages and are still waiting to get their payments, which have been held up and have actually filed further lawsuits to compel Venezuela to basically hand over the cash. So it's a little bit broader. One of those companies that has already been awarded, I believe it's several hundred million dollars. These are very, you know, large sums from these from these investor state dispute settlements. One of them is a minerals company, Gold Reserves LLC, and one of their financial partners in the case that they'd filed a couple of years ago against Venezuela, after the invasion this past week, came out and said very openly, publicly to the press, that their kind of key interest here and why they're excited about the invasion is that they will finally be able to, you know, get the money that they claim that they've, you know, owed and that's been sort of rubber stamped by the courts here. And I think that really has kind of put out into the open what is sort of the end game here for many of these, you know, companies that still have pending cases. You know, I think really sort of in the past, you've seen, you know, very large sums, largely by the oil and gas companies that have filed these cases for the seizure of oil fields. And, you know, I think now the hope is that sort of with a more favorable government coming in, that's backed by the U.S., they will either just, you know, settle beforehand these cases, or, you know, they may not just, you know, frankly, adequately argue them in the arbitration tribunal courts, which would kind of lead to the same outcome here.
Well, just to zoom out a bit, Luke, where is the oil industry in terms of this overall intervention? I mean, as you suggest, they may be able to profit from these lawsuits if they get a favorable settlement or adjudication. At the same time, though, oil prices are low right now. It takes a long time and billions of dollars to get that sector back up and running. So it seems like some of the comments from oil industry executives have been a little bit tepid about how likely it is that they're going to be able to go into Venezuela and profit. So even just thinking beyond these legal cases, what is the sort of relationship at this point between the U.S. oil industry and what the prospects might be for them to go in and take that oil, to paraphrase Trump?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm really just speaking here, you know, kind of as a lay person. I'm reading the same things as everyone else. I mean, I think, you know, for anyone who's followed these kinds of invasions in the past, it's kind of jarring actually to hear a U.S. president just say outright, "We're doing this because of the oil." And I think that even in itself raises maybe some suspicions about what the full end game is here. I mean, as you said, I've seen many reports from U.S. oil producers who are actually not entirely enthused about the prospect, well, I guess twofold, but the prospect of flooding the market with a bunch of, you know, new oil from Venezuela, given how low the current commodity prices are for oil. You know, more supply would theoretically drop the price even further. And I think on the other end, from some of the larger oil and gas companies that do the actual extraction, there is some skepticism that, again, given the current oil prices, they would want to invest so much capital to extract a kind of, you know, heavier, kind of thicker kind of oil, which is, you know, native to Venezuela. My understanding is they have such large reserves, but, you know, not you know, a lot of it's not kind of being extracted and produced at as high of a level as other countries with large reserves. But, you know, again, as my kind of piece gets into, it's not just oil and gas interests here. What you see from these list of companies is it's other natural resources. It's there's a lot of you have a lot of international mining companies that have been suing Venezuela over the expropriation of, you know, property. I guess that's just the legal term of art, at least. You have another. So, I mean, you know, one thing also to say is Halliburton, of course, has been a longtime GOP aligned company. Another company, Williams Corporation, their board is stacked with a number of officials who've given hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to the GOP. The list includes Kellogg's as well, the giant, you know, food company. And then you have a sort of variety of some smaller kind of interests, packaging, construction. But it really shows the kind of breadth of different industries here that have direct business interests in Venezuela and would, you know, stand to benefit from some kind of turnover in leadership.
And do we have any reporting or indications of what these companies, I mean, it is diverse, as you mentioned. I mean, to go from, you know, Kellogg's, the giant food company, to these energy companies, it's really a diverse array of companies that are involved and want, you know, financial damages from Venezuela. What are their connections to the Trump administration? Do we know, you know, have they been contributing to the Trump campaign? And we know in the case of oil companies, they certainly are oil executives. What are the ties there? What might they be?
Yeah, I mean, I think oil and gas has definitely been the most kind of politically connected and intertwined with the GOP, and, as you know, as well as, you know, the current Trump administration. You know, the other companies really kind of spread the feel. I think they kind of play the kind of sort of traditional campaign contribution game where they sort of will contribute to, you know, kind of both sides to make sure that they're lined up well. You know, I think the reason, you know, Halliburton also, I think, will stick in many listeners' minds, of course, is that, you know, their former CEO was the Vice President Dick Cheney, who, you know, was instrumental in launching the invasion war in Iraq. And, you know, Halliburton really kind of played a similar game there as well. After the U.S. occupied the country and backed a new government, Halliburton then was awarded a number of very lucrative contracts with that government to, you know, kind of assist in administering the energy operations in the country and oil extraction. So I think in a lot of ways, this kind of, you know, sort of comes full circle. They have kind of made this play before, and it seems that they have kind of lined things up to sort of run this playbook once again in Venezuela.
Well, Luke, we're just about out of time, but I can't let you go without asking, what are you kind of looking for next on this story? You know, we've got these lawsuits pending. What are the upcoming milestones that you might be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to follow the developments with the Halliburton case. So, you know, again, I'm reading what these companies are saying, either in earnings calls or to the press, as one of the mining companies with a pending case has said to Bloomberg, you know, that they're definitely eyeing getting their payday now with a turnover in leadership in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. You know, there will be some updates, however, maybe sparse from the courts. And, you know, I think this really just does open up a whole kind of can of worms. There are a lot of U.S. investors who hold debt or bondholders of Venezuelan debt who have also said that they're kind of, you know, keen on sort of seeing their returns, which have been held up, is my understanding, for several years. This is a similar, just to kind of underscore, this is a similar process that's played out in a number of other Latin American countries and also in Puerto Rico. There's actually a current Supreme Court case by U.S. investors seeking damages in Cuba as well. Yeah. So it's not just Venezuela.
Well, I think you're onto a very important story here, Luke. Really appreciate your reporting on it and for joining us here on Your Call. Luke Goldstein, reporter at The Lever, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, that is our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, find our Your Call page at kalw.org and click on news. We're also on iTunes. You can give us a review there. And follow us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.